Chapter 7 Blacksmith's Puzzle. When the laughter cut off, Aram put on a smug grin, and with none of the fierce scent he had given off earlier. Anyone would have thought he had already seen the tracks himself and knew everything there was to know. No one paid any mind to his smirk, however, or to much of anything except the huge dog tracks impressed in stone, even Perrin's explanation that the dark hounds were long gone. Of course, he could not tell them how he knew that, yet no one seemed to notice the lack. One of the sharply slanting bars of early morning light was falling directly on the gray slab, illuminating it clearly. Stepper had grown accustomed to the fading burnt sulfur smell. At least he only snorted and laid back his ears, but the other horses shied at the tilted stone. None of the humans except Perrin could detect that smell, and most growled over their mount's fractious behavior and peered at the oddly marked stone as if it were a curiosity displayed by a traveling show. Berylaine's plump maid screamed when she saw the tracks and swayed on the point of falling off her round-bellied, nervously dancing mare, but Berylaine merely asked Nora in an absent fashion to look after her, and stared at the prince with as little expression as if she herself were Aes Sedai. Her hands tightened on her reins, though, until the thin red leather paled across her knuckles. Bertin Galen, the Lord Captain of the Winged Guards, his red helmet embossed with wings and bearing three thin crimson plumes, had personal command of Berylaine's bodyguard this morning, and he forced his tall black gelding close to the stone, swinging down from his saddle in knee-deep snow and removing his helmet, to frown at the stone slab with his one eye. A scarlet leather patch covered the empty socket of the other, the strap cutting through his shoulder-length gray hair. His grimace said he saw trouble, but he always saw the worst possibilities first. Perrin supposed that was better in a soldier than always seeing the best. Masuri dismounted too, but no sooner was she on the ground than she paused with her dapple's reins in one gloved hand, looking uncertainly toward the three sun-dark Aiel women. A few of the Mayenner soldiers muttered uneasily at that, yet they should have been used to it by now. Nora hid her face deeper in her gray hood as if she did not want to see the rock, and gave Berylaine's maid a brisk shake. The woman goggled at her in astonishment. Masuri, on the other hand, waited beside her mare with an appearance of patience, spoiled only by smoothing the russet skirts of her silk riding dress, as though unaware of what she was doing. The wise ones exchanged silent glances, expressionless as sisters themselves. Karel stood on one side of Navarin, a skinny green-eyed woman, and on the other, Marlene, with eyes of twilight blue and dark hair, rare among Aiel, not covered completely with her shawl. All three were tall women, as tall as some men, and none looked more than a few years older than Perrin, but no one could have managed that calm self-assurance without more years than their faces claimed. Despite the long necklaces and heavy bracelets of gold and ivory that they wore, their dark heavy skirts and the dark shawls that almost hid their white blouses could have suited farm women, yet there was no doubt who was in command between them and the Aes Sedai. In truth, sometimes there seemed to be doubt who was in command between them and Perrin. Finally, Navarin nodded and gave a warm and approving smile. Perrin had never before seen a smile out of her. Navarin did not walk around scowling, but she usually seemed to be searching for someone to upbraid. Not until that nod did Masuri hand her reins up to one of the soldiers. Her warder was nowhere to be seen, and that had to be the wise one's doing. Rovere usually stuck to her like a burr. Lifting her divided skirts, she waded through the snow, deeper the closer to the stone she came, and began passing her hands above the footprints, obviously channeling, though nothing happened that Perrin could see. The wise ones watched her closely, but then Masuri's weaves were visible to them. Anura displayed no interest. The ends of the Grey Sister's narrow braids twitched as if she were shaking her head inside her hood, and she moved her horse back from the maid, well out of the wise one's line of sight, though that took her farther from Berylaine, who anyone could think might want her advice now. Anura really did avoid the wise ones as much as she could.
"Fireside stories walking,"
Galen muttered, drawing his gelding away from the stone with a sideways glance at Masuri. Aes Sedai he honored, yet few men wanted to be close to an Aes Sedai who was channeling.
"Though I don't know why I'm surprised any more after what I've seen since leaving Marianne."
Intent on the tracks, Masuri did not seem to notice him. A stir rippled through the mounted lancers, as though they had not really believed their own eyes until their commander gave confirmation, and some of them began to smell of uneasy fear, as if expecting dark hounds to leap out of the shadows. Perrin could not pick out individuals among so many with any ease, but the jittery rankness was strong enough that it had to come from more than a few. Galen seemed to sense what Perrin smelled. He had his faults, but he had commanded soldiers for a long time. Hanging his helmet on his longsword hilt, he grinned. The eye patch gave it a grim quality, a man who could see a joke in the face of death and expected others to see it too.
"If the black dogs bother us, we'll salt their ears," he announced in a loud and hearty voice. "That's what you do in the stories, isn't it? Sprinkle salt in their ears and they vanish."
A few of the Lancers laughed, though the miasma of fear did not lessen appreciably. Stories told by the fire were one thing, those same stories walking in the flesh quite another. Galen led his black to Berylaine and rested a gauntleted hand on her bay's neck. He gave Perrin a considering look that Perrin returned levelly, refusing to take the hint. Whatever the man had to say, he could say in front of him and Aram. Galen sighed.
"They will keep their nerve, m'lady," he said softly. "But the fact is, our position is precarious, with enemies on every side and our supplies running out. Shadowspawn can only make matters worse. My duty is to you and Mayen, m'lady. And with all respect to Lord Perrin, you may wish to alter your plans."
Anger crackled in Perrin. The man would abandon Fael? But Berylaine spoke before he could suggest it.
"There will be no alteration, Lord Galen."
Sometimes it was easy to forget that she was a ruler, small though Mayen was, but there was a regal tone in her voice, fit for the Queen of Andor. Back straight, she made her saddle seem a throne, and she spoke loudly enough to make sure everyone heard her decision, firmly enough that everyone knew the decision had been made.
"If we have enemies all around, then going on is as safe as turning back or turning aside. Yet if turning back or turning aside were 10 times safer, I would still go on. I intend to see the Lady Fael rescued if we must fight our way through 1,000 Dark Hounds and Trollocs as well. That I have sworn to do."
A roar of cheers answered her, winged guards shouting and thrusting their lances into the air so the red streamers danced. The smell of fear remained, but they sounded ready to cut their way through any number of Trollocs, rather than appear less in Berylaine's eyes. Galen commanded them, but they felt more than fondness for their ruler, despite her reputation with men. Maybe because of it, in part. Berylaine had kept Tyr from swallowing Mayen by playing one man who found her beautiful against another. For his part, Perrin found it hard not to gape in surprise. She sounded as determined as he was. She smelled as determined. Galen bowed his gray head in unwilling acceptance, and Berylaine gave a small, satisfied nod before turning her attention to the Aes Sedai beside the stone slab. Musiri had stopped waving her hands about and was staring at the footprints, tapping a finger against her lips thoughtfully. She was a pretty woman without being beautiful, though some of that might have been Aes Sedai agelessness, with a grace and elegance that might also have come from being Aes Sedai. It was often difficult to tell a sister who had been born on a hardscrabble farm from one born in a grand palace. Perrin had seen her red-faced and angry, worn down and on the end of her tether. Yet despite hard travel and life in the Aiel tents, her dark hair and her clothing looked as though she had a maid attending her, too. She might have been standing in a library.
"What have you learned, Musiri?" Berylaine asked. "Musiri, if you please. Musiri!"
The last came a little more sharply, and Musiri gave a start, as though surprised to realize she was not alone. Possibly she was startled. In many ways, she seemed more of the green Aja than the brown, more intent on action than on contemplation. Straight to the point and never vague. Yet she was still capable of losing herself completely in whatever captured her interest. Folding her hands at her waist, she opened her mouth, but rather than speaking, she hesitated and looked a question at the wise ones.
"Go on, girl," Navarin said impatiently, planting her fists on her hips in a jangle of bracelets.
A frown made her appear more her usual self, but neither of the other wise ones looked any more approving. 3 frowns in a row, like 3 pale-eyed crows on a fence.
"We were not simply letting you exercise your curiosity. Get on with it. Tell us what you learned."
Musiri's face reddened, but she spoke up immediately, her eyes on Berylaine. She could not like being called down in public, no matter what anyone knew of her relationship with the Wise Ones.
"Relatively little is known of Dark Hounds, but I've made something of a study of them in a small way. Over the years, I've crossed the paths of 7 packs, 5 of them twice, and 2 others 3 times.
The color began to fade from her cheeks, and slowly she began to sound as if she were lecturing.
"Some ancient writers say there are only 7 packs. Others say 9 or 13, or some other number they believed had special significance. but during the Trolloc Wars, Sorlana Alsahan wrote of the 100 packs of the Shadow's hounds that hunt the night. And even earlier, Ivanel Bharatiya supposedly wrote of hounds born of the Shadow in numbers like unto the nightmares of mankind. Though in truth, Ivanel herself may be apocryphal. In any case, she gestured as if groping for a word. Smell is not the right word, and neither is flavor. The sense of each pack is unique, and I can say with certainty that I have never encountered this one before, so we know the number 7 is wrong. Whether the correct number is 9 or 13 or something else, tales of Darkhounds are much more common than Darkhounds themselves, and they are extremely rare this far south of the Blight. A second rarity, there may have been as many as 50 in this pack. 10 or 12 is the usual limit. A useful maxim, two rarities combined call for close attention. Pausing, she raised a finger to emphasize the point, then nodded when she thought Berylaine had taken it, and folded her hands again. A gusting breeze pushed her yellowish-brown cloak off one shoulder, yet she did not appear to notice the loss of warmth. There is always a feel of urgency about Darkhound's trails, but it varies according to a number of factors, not all of which I can be certain of. This one has an intense admixture of, I suppose you could call it impatience. That isn't really strong enough by far. As well call a stab wound a pinprick, but it will do. I would say their hunt has been going on for some time, and their prey is eluding them somehow. No matter what the stories say, by the way, Lord Gallen, salt doesn't harm Darkhounds in the least. So she had not been entirely lost in thought after all. Despite the stories, they never hunt at random, though they will kill if the opportunity presents itself and doesn't interfere with the hunt. With Darkhounds, the hunt is paramount. Their quarry is always important to the Shadow, though at times we cannot see why. They have been known to bypass the great and mighty, to slay a farm wife or a craftsman, or to enter a town or village and leave without killing, though clearly they came for some reason. My first thought for what brought them here had to be discarded since they moved on. Her gaze flickered toward Perrin, so quickly he was not sure anyone else noticed. Given that, I strongly doubt they will return. Oh, yes, and they are an hour or more gone. That, I'm afraid, is really all I can tell you. Navarin and the other wise ones nodded their approval as she finished, and a touch of color returned to her cheeks, though it vanished quickly as she assumed a mask of Aes Sedai serenity. A shift in the breeze brought her scent to Perrin, surprised and pleased, and upset at being pleased.
Thank you, Masuri Sedai,
Berylaine said formally, making a small bow in her saddle that Masuri acknowledged with a slight motion of her head.
You have put our minds at rest.
Indeed, the fear smell among the soldiers began to fade, though Perrin heard Galen grumble under his breath. She might have told those last bits first. Perrin's ears caught something else, too, through the stamping of horses' hooves and men's quiet, relieved laughter. A blue-tit's trill sounded to the south, beyond the hearing of anyone else there, followed closely by the buzzing call of a masked sparrow. Another blue-tit sounded, closer, followed again by a masked sparrow, and then the same pair called again, closer still. There might be blue-tits and masked sparrows in Altara, but he knew these birds carried Two Rivers longbows. The blue-tit meant men were coming, more than a few, and maybe unfriendly. The masked sparrow, that some back home called the thief bird for its habit of stealing bright objects, on the other hand. Perrin ran a thumb along the edge of his axe, but he waited for one more pair of calls, close enough that the others might have noticed. "Did you hear that?" he said, looking south as if he had just heard. "My sentries have spotted Massima." That brought heads up, listening, and several men nodded when the calls were repeated, closer still. "He's coming this way." Growling curses, Galen clapped his helmet onto his head and mounted. Anura gathered her reins, and Masuri began floundering back toward her dapple. The lancers shifted in their saddles and began giving off smells of anger, once more touched with fear. The winged guards were owed a blood debt by Massima in their eyes, but none was anxious to try collecting with only 50 men, not when Massima always rode with 100 at his back.
"I will not run from him," Berylaine announced.
She stared south, wearing a cold frown.
"We will wait for him here."
Galen opened his mouth and closed it again without speaking, to her at least. Drawing a deep breath, he began to bellow orders arraying his guardsmen. This was not an easy matter. No matter how far apart the trees stood, forests were poor places for lancers. Any charge would be disjointed at its start, and sticking a man with a lance was difficult when he could dodge behind a tree trunk and come out behind you. Garland tried to form them in front of Berlaine, between her and the approaching men, but she gave him a sharp look, and the one-eyed man changed his commands, lining the lancers up in a single crooked rank, bulging around massive trees but centered on her. One soldier Galen sent racing back toward the camp, crouching low in his saddle with his lance low, as if at the charge, riding as fast as he could in spite of the snow and terrain. Berlaine raised an eyebrow at that, yet said nothing. Anura began guiding her brown mare toward Berlaine, but stopped when Missouri called her name. The brown sister had gathered her dapple, but still stood in the snow with the wise ones around her, who were tall enough in comparison to make her seem less than full-grown. Anura hesitated until Missouri summoned her again, more sharply, and then Perrin thought he heard Anura sigh heavily before she rode to them and dismounted. Whatever the Aiel women had to say, in voices pitched too softly for Perrin to hear, clustering in front of Anura with heads bent close to hers, the Terrabana sister did not like. Her face remained hidden in her hood, but her thin braids swung ever faster with the shaking of her head, and at last she turned away abruptly and put a foot in the stirrup of her saddle. Missouri had been standing quietly, letting the wise ones have their say, but now she laid a hand on Anura's sleeve and said something in a low voice that made Anura's shoulders slump, and the wise ones nod. Pushing back her hood to fall down her back, Anura waited for Missouri to climb onto her mare before mounting her own horse, and then the two sisters rode back to the line of lancers together, crowding in beside Berlaine with the wise ones pushing in between them, on the other side from Perrin. Anura's wide mouth was turned down in a glum curve, and she was rubbing her thumbs nervously. "What is it you're planning?" Perrin asked, trying not to hide suspicion. Maybe the wise ones had let Missouri meet with Massima, yet they still claimed to think the man was better dead. The Aes Sedai could not use the power as a weapon unless they were in danger, but the wise ones had no such prohibition. He wondered whether they were linked. He knew more than he wanted about the One Power, and enough about the wise ones to be sure that Navarin would be in control if they had formed a circle. Anura opened her mouth, but snapped it shut at a warning touch from Karel, and glared at Missouri. The brown sister pursed her lips and shook her head slightly, which did not seem to mollify Anura. Her gloved hands gripped her reins so tightly that they shook. Navarin looked up at Perrin past Berlaine, as if she read his mind.
"We plan to see you safely back to the camp, Perrin Ebarra," she said sharply. "You and Berlaine, Perron. We plan to see that as many as possible survive this day and the days to come. Do you have objections?"
"Just don't do anything unless I tell you," he said.
An answer like that could mean a lot of things.
"Not anything."
Navarin shook her head in disgust, and Karel laughed as if he had made a huge joke. None of the wise ones seemed to think any more response was needed. They had been commanded to obey him, but their notions of obedience failed to square with any he had ever learned. Pigs would grow wings before he got a better answer out of them. He could have put a stop to it. He knew he should. No matter what the wise ones had planned, meeting Massima this far from the others in the camp, when the man had to know who had stolen his Shonchan paper, was like hoping to snatch your hand off the anvil before the hammer fell. Berlaine was almost as bad as the wise ones when it came to following orders, but he thought she would listen if he gave an order to withdraw to the camp. He thought she would, for all that her smell said she had dug her heels in hard. Staying was a senseless risk. He was sure he could convince her of that. Yet he did not want to run from the man either. Part of him said he was being a fool. The larger part smoldered with anger that he found hard to control. Aram crowded in beside him, scowling, but at least he had not drawn his sword. Waving a sword might put a hot coal in the hayloft, and the time for a confrontation with Massima had not come yet. Perrin rested a hand on his axe. Not yet. Despite the sharply angled rays of light that penetrated through the thick branches overhead, the forest as a whole lay wrapped in dim early morning shadows. Even at noon it would be dim here. Sounds came to him first, the muffled thud of hooves in snow, the heavy breath of horses pushed for speed, and then a mass of riders appeared, a disordered mob flowing north among the huge trees at a near gallop in spite of snow and rough ground. Rather than 100, they numbered 2 or 3 times that. A horse went down with a scream and lay thrashing atop its rider, but none of the others so much as slowed until, some 70 or 80 paces away, the man at their head raised a hand, and they suddenly drew rein in sprays of snow, lathered horses blowing hard and steaming. Here and there lances stuck up among the riders. Most wore no armor, and many just a breastplate or a helmet, yet their saddles were hung about with swords and axes and maces. Shafts of sunlight picked out a few faces, grim, flat-eyed men who looked as though they had never smiled and never would. It occurred to Perrin that he might have made a mistake not to overrule Berylaine. That was what came of hasty decisions, of letting anger do his thinking. Everyone knew that she often rode out in the mornings, and Massima might be desperate to recover his Shonchen document. Even with the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones, a fight in these woods could turn bloody, a free-for-all where men and women could die without once seeing who killed them. If no witnesses lived, it could always be blamed on bandits or even the Shido. That had happened before. And if there were witnesses left, Massima was not above hanging a few dozen of his own men and claiming the guilty had been punished. He likely wanted to keep Perrin Ibarra alive for a while yet, though, and he would not have expected the Wise Ones or a second Aes Sedai. Small points to hang 50-odd lives on. Very small points to hang Fael's life on. Perrin eased his axe in its loop on his belt. Beside him, Berylaine smelled of cool calm and stony determination. No fear, oddly. Not a whiff. Aram smelled excited. The two parties sat regarding one another in silence, until at last Massima rode forward, followed by just two men, all three pushing back their hoods. None wore a helmet or any piece of armor. Like Massima, Nengar and Bartu were Shinaran, but unlike him, they had shaved off their topknots, leaving bare heads with a look of skulls. The coming of the Dragon Reborn had broken all bonds, including those that had pledged these men to fight the Shadow along the Blight. Nengar and Bartu each carried a sword on his back and had another hanging at his saddle bow, and Bartu, shorter than the other two, had a cased horse bow and a quiver fastened to his saddle, too. Massima wore no visible weapons. The prophet of the Lord Dragon Reborn needed none. Perrin was glad to see Galen watching the men Massima had left behind, for there was something about Massima that drew the eye. Maybe it was only knowing who he was, but that was more than enough. Massima stopped his rangy sorrel a few paces from Perrin. The prophet was a dark, frowning man of average size, with a faded arrow scar white on his cheek. In a worn brown woolen coat and a dark cloak with frayed edges. Massima cared nothing for appearances, least of all his own. At his back, Nengar and Bartu held a fever in their eyes, but Massima's deep-set, almost black eyes seemed as hot as coals in a forge, as though the breezes must soon fan them to a glow, and his smell was the jangled, darting sharpness of pure insanity. He ignored the Wise Ones in Aes Sedai with a scorn he did not bother to hide. Wise Ones were worse than Aes Sedai, in his view. They not only blasphemed by channeling the One Power, they were Aiel savages to boot, a double sin. The waned guards could have been just more shadows beneath the trees. "You're taking a picnic," he said, with a glance at the basket hanging from Perrin's saddle. Normally Massima's voice was as intense as his eyes, but now it sounded wry, and his lip curled as his eyes traveled to Berylaine. He had heard the rumors, of course. A wave of rage shot through Perrin, but he seized onto it, forcing it back, folding it in with the rest, folding it tight. His anger had one target, and he would not waste it striking at another. Catching his rider's mood, Stepper bared his teeth at Massima's gelding, and Perrin had to rein him in sharply. "There were dark hounds here in the night," he said, not very smoothly, but it was the best he could manage. "They're gone, and Masuri doesn't think they'll come back, so there's no need to worry." Massima did not smell worried. He never smelled of anything except madness. The sorrel thrust his head aggressively toward Stepper, but Massima pulled him up with a harsh jerk. He rode well, Massima did, but he treated his horses as he did people. For the first time, he looked at Massuri. Perhaps his gaze grew a little hotter, if that was possible. "The Shadow can be found everywhere," he said, a heated pronouncement of unquestionable truth. "No one need fear the Shadow who follows the Lord Dragon Reborn, may the light illumine his name. Even in death they will find the final victory of the light." Masuri's mare shied as though burned by that gaze, yet Massuri controlled the animal with a touch on the reins and met Massima's stare with Aes Sedai inscrutability, as calm as a frozen pond. Nothing hinted that she had been meeting this man in secret. "Fear is a useful spur to the wits, and to determination when well controlled. If we have no fear of our enemies, that leaves only contempt,
and contempt leads to the enemy's victory. You could have thought she was speaking to a simple farmer she had never met before. Anura, watching, looked a little ill. Was she afraid their secret would come out? That their plans for Massima could be spoiled? Massima's lip curled again in a smile, or a sneer. The Aes Sedai seemed to cease to exist for him as he turned his attention back to Perrin.
Some of those who follow the Lord Dragon have found a town called Sohebor.
That was how he always referred to his followers. They really followed the Dragon Reborn, not him. The fact that Massima told them what to do and when and how was just a detail.
A tidy place of 3,000 or 4,000 people, about a day back, or a little less, to the south and west. It seems they were out of the Aiel's path and their crop was good last year despite the drought. They have storehouses full of barley, millet, and oats, and other needful things, I should imagine. I know you are running short on fodder, for your men as well as your horses.
Why would their storehouses be full this time of year?
Berylaine leaned forward with a frown, her tone just short of a demand, and not far short of disbelief. Scowling, Nengar put a hand to his saddle sword. No one made demands of the prophet of the Lord Dragon. No one doubted him either. No one who wished to live. Leather creaked as lancers shifted their saddles, but Nengar ignored them. The smell of Massima's madness slithered and flailed in Perrin's nose. Massima studied Berylaine. He seemed unaware of Nengar, or the lancers, or the possibility that men might start killing one another any moment.
"A matter of greed," he said finally. "Apparently the grain traders of Sohebor thought to make larger profits by holding their stock until winter drove prices up. But they normally sell west, into Gildan and Amadisia, and events there and in Ebu Dar have made them fearful that anything they send out will be confiscated. Their greed has left them with full storehouses and empty purses."
A note of satisfaction entered Massima's voice. He despised greed. But then, he despised any human weakness, great or small.
"I think they will part with their grain very cheaply now."
Perrin smelled a trap, and it did not take a wolf's nose. Massima had his own men and horses to feed, and no matter how thoroughly they had scoured the country they crossed, they could not be in much better shape than Perrin's own people. Why had Massima not sent a few thousand of his followers into this town and taken whatever it held?
A day back.
That would take him farther from Fail, and maybe give the Shido time to gain ground again. Was that the reason for this peculiar offer? Or a further delay to keep Massima in the west, close to his Seanchan friends?
"Perhaps there will be time to visit this town after my wife is free."
Once again, Perrin's ears caught the faint sound of men and horses moving through the forest before anyone else, coming from the west this time, from the camp. Galen's messenger must have galloped the whole way.
"Your wife,"
Massima said in a flat voice, directing a look at Berylaine that made Perrin's blood boil. Even Berylaine colored, though her face remained smooth.
"Do you really believe you will have word of her today?"
"I do."
Perrin's voice was as flat as Massima's, and harder. He clutched the pommel of his saddle, atop the hoop handles of Berylaine's basket, to keep from reaching for his axe.
"Freeing her comes first. Her and the others. We can fill our bellies to bursting once that's done, but that comes first."
The horses approaching were audible to everyone now. A long line of lancers appeared to the west, shifting through the shadowed trees with another mounted line behind it. The red streamers and breastplates of Mayen interspersed with the green streamers and burnished breastplates of Gildan. The lines stretched from opposite Perrin down below the mass of horsemen who were waiting on Massima. Men afoot ghosted from tree to tree, carrying long Two Rivers bows. Perrin found himself hoping they had not stripped the camp too far. Stealing that Seanchan paper might have forced Massima's hand, and he was a veteran of fighting along the Blight and against the Aiel. He might have thought further ahead than simply riding out to find Berylaine. It was like another blacksmith's puzzle. Move one piece to shift another just enough to let a third slip free. A camp with weakened defenders could be overrun, and in these woods numbers could count for as much as who had people channeling. Did Massima want to keep his secret enough to try putting a seal to it here and now? Perrin realized that he had moved one hand to rest on his axe, but he left it there. Among the mass of Massima's followers, horses moved nervously at tugs from their riders. Men shouted and waved weapons, but Massima himself studied the oncoming lancers and bowmen with no change of expression, neither more dour nor less. They might have been birds hopping from branch to branch.
The smell of him writhed madly, unchanging.
"What is done to serve the light must be done," he said, when the newcomers halted, some 200 paces away. That was easy range for a Two Rivers bowman, and Massima had seen demonstrations, but he gave no sign that broadhead shafts might be aimed at his heart. "All else is dross and trash. Remember that, Lord Baron Golden Eyes. Everything else is dross and trash."
Jerking his sorrel around without another word, he headed back toward his waiting men, trailed by N'Gar and Bartu, all three pushing their horses without a care for broken legs or broken heads. The waiting company fell in behind, a mob flowing south now. A few men at the tail end stopped to drag a limp shape from under the injured horse and put the animal out of its misery with a quick slash of a dagger. Then they began gutting and butchering. That much meat could not be allowed to go to waste. The rider they left where they had dropped him.
"He believes every word he says," Honora breathed. "But where does his belief lead him?"
Perrin considered asking her straight out where she thought Massima's belief was leading him, where she wanted to lead him. But she suddenly put on that impenetrable Aes Sedai calm. The tip of her sharp nose had turned red from the cold. She regarded him with a level stare.
"You could pry that dark hand marked stone out of the ground barehanded as easily as get an answer from an Aes Sedai who wore that look."
He would have to leave questions to Barilane. The man who had brought the lancers suddenly spurred his horse forward. A short, compact fellow in a silver-plated breastplate and a helmet with a barred face guard and 3 short white plumes, Gerard Arganda was a tough man, a soldier who had worked his way up from the bottom, against all odds, to become the first captain of Alejandra's bodyguard. He had no liking for Perrin, who had brought his queen south for no good reason and gotten her kidnapped, but Perrin expected him to stop and make his respects to Barilane, perhaps confer with Galen. Arganda had a great deal of respect for Galen, and often spent time with him, both smoking their pipes. Instead, the roan floundered past Perrin and the others, Arganda digging his heels into the animal's sides, trying to force more speed. When Perrin saw where the man was heading, he understood. A single horseman on a mouse-colored animal was approaching from the east at a steady walk, and beside him an Aiel shuffled along on snowshoes.